It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the election for a seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court is the most expensive race of its type in U.S. history. We'll look at where the money is flowing and what messages the candidates are focusing on. First, we may be witnessing the end of a golden era of television. That's according to the TV executive who first coined the phrase peak TV in 2015. As streaming services start to scale back, the number of new original scripted TV shows is expected to shrink this year after reaching a record high of 599 last year. While streaming TV started out with a big splash, it now finds itself under pressure to produce profits. And viewers may feel this pressure in terms of streaming costs, variety, and availability. Our next guest says you can already see signs of the end of peak TV, and we need to prepare ourselves for what he thinks is coming next, trough TV. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Now, what is your favorite show to stream right now if you have a favorite? Or is there one that you feel betrayed? You started watching it, then they stopped creating it after you finished a season or two. How do you manage the seemingly infinite number of streaming subscription options out there? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sam Adams is senior editor for Slate.com. Sam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
It felt for a while, Sam, like there was this infinitely expanding universe of streaming options. There were more and more channels. They got bigger and bigger, had more stuff. What's happening now?
Well, I started thinking about this thing that I ended up calling Trough TV towards the end of last summer. I didn't quite recognize the feeling at first because it had been so long, but I started to feel like there was nothing good on TV. As you mentioned, they made 600 new shows last year. That's impossible. Clearly there's something on, but it just started bringing back all these feelings from when I started watching TV in the 80s and 90s when, you know, there were weeks and months where there was nothing good to watch on. And if you didn't catch a show the first time, you might have to wait a couple of years to see it again, or you just might never see it again. And you might have to go, you know, ask your friend what happened or look up a summary on the internet. I felt it's been about 10 years of streaming TV now. It's almost exactly 10 years since House of Cards premiered on Netflix. And a lot of the stuff, those kinds of experiences seemed like they were gone forever, but they're starting to, because of the pressures you mentioned in the intro, they're starting to come back. Shows are getting canceled midstream when the stories are untold. Shows are actually disappearing from streaming, and because there's no longer a VHS or DVD backup, they're just gone for good, or at least until somebody else finds a way to turn a small profit putting them back. So it feels in a way like we're regressing to where we were before this all started. And I wouldn't say things are going exactly back to the way they were, but a lot of things that seemed like they were gone for good, it turns out that TV is still TV.
Yeah, can you talk about that? I think we have this sense that, or I had the sense that, okay, a show's up on a streaming channel, it's going to be there forever. Or maybe, you know, the rights will go to another channel or something like that. We're starting to see newer shows, older shows like Arrested Development, just what? Disappear?
Right. One of the examples that got me thinking about this is Arrested Development. It's, I think, you know, the second or third sort of big high profile Netflix original. They revived this sort of beloved but low rated Fox sitcom, put all three seasons on Netflix, and then they made two new seasons. And now, 10 years later, those agreements have expired. The first three seasons that were made for Fox in the old ecosystem, those are just, I think, on Hulu now. You can find them just somewhere else on the internet other than Netflix. But the two seasons that got made for Netflix are just kind of gone now. Nobody knows where you can find them or if you're going to be able to find them. I think one of them you could buy digitally, and then one of them is just kind of in limbo. HBO Max last year, because of the merger and new corporate leadership, they had this basically this whole initiative to kind of cut a lot of dead weight from the HBO Max service. And that included both, you know, a $1 billion series like Westworld and also these tiny little shows with beloved followings like the Gordita Chronicles. And some of those have gone to places like Tubi, which is basically like old-fashioned TV where there are ads in the middle and you have to watch it at the time it's on or you can't see it. And some of them, again, are just gone for now, at least.
We're talking about big changes in the world of TV, especially streaming TV, with Sam Adams, senior editor for Slate.com. He wrote a piece on this just a little while back, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you stream TV? What do you stream? How do you decide which, if any, channels to subscribe to? Have you been burned by getting hooked on a show and the show has gone away? I got at least three on my list where I started. Would have watched more. Ain't no more. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's jump into a few networks now. And to kick off Disney Plus, here's the previously on The Mandalorian from the Star Wars universe on Disney Plus, starring Pedro Pascal.
You do not cover your face. You are not Mandalorian.
You are a child of the Watch.
There is only one way. The way of the Mandalore.
Din Djarin. Have you ever removed your helmet?
I have.
Then you are a Mandalorian no more.
How can I atone?
According to creed, one may only be redeemed in the living waters beneath the mines of Mandalore.
But the mines have all been destroyed.
This is the way.
Bummer. No more Mandalorian, except there is more Mandalorian, the show. Now, Sam, Disney, where The Mandalorian airs, they've got the Star Wars properties there, but they just laid off. They announced a lot of layoffs throughout the Disney world of entertainment. What are we seeing when it comes to Disney Plus's streaming channel?
Yeah, well, what happened, just a sort of brief history of the last few years, everybody kind of rushed into the streaming arena at the same time, which happened to be everybody was sort of planning to do it. Paramount, Disney, Warner Brothers were all planning to do this right around the time of the pandemic, obviously not knowing that was going to happen, but it made it seem like everything was going really well for a while because obviously people had nothing to do but sit home and watch TV. But eventually that sort of bubble burst, and now we're seeing a lot of cost cutting, retrenchment, just these massive losses. For example, so Disney is now cutting 7,000 jobs and over $5 billion in revenue, and trying to. One of the major things that happened with the executive switch last year, where they brought Bob Iger back in to replace Bob Chapek, is that Chapek had really sort of overinvested in the idea of streaming being completely the future, and Disney movies were going to go straight to streaming and not even go into movie theaters. And that just turned out to be not the way to actually make the kind of money that Disney is used to making. So it seemed like there was gold in their hills for everybody. And now that everybody is in the same hills looking for the same gold, it turns out that there's not as much as they thought.
Now, for people who like to watch cool stuff on TV, Sam, what do the next couple years hold, do you think, when it comes to the content, the quantity, and the quality that people are going to be able to see?
Well, we're certainly going to be seeing fewer new shows. That is not something you're necessarily going to notice. I mean, if there were 600 new shows last year and there are 500 new shows this year, you're not going to notice those 100 missing shows per se. You know, there's still going to be way more TV than any human being, even one who's paid to do it for a living like me, can possibly get to. But there is a sort of an erosion in quality that I think has been creeping in. And it's the kind of thing that you don't notice unless you sort of stand back and pay a little bit of attention to it. You know, House of the Dragon kind of feels like Game of Thrones, and maybe it's not quite as good, but it's on Sunday nights at 9 on HBO, and it sort of scratches that itch. So you just go with it. But I was having a discussion with some friends just last week about the show The Americans that was on FX, and that was a real sort of golden age of TV, peak TV show. Just a really classic drama that went out over six seasons, told this really big, elaborate story with these amazing characters. And I just feel like that kind of storytelling, what really made TV special in the first place, is endangered now. Shows are not getting, a show like Schitt's Creek, which started off as a really kind of marginal property on this little Canadian network, and then after six seasons became this, you know, Emmy-dominating juggernaut. I don't think it would get to six seasons now. And so we're not getting as many of those rich, long-form stories as, you know, we like, as the kind of thing that TV does best, is really becoming harder and harder to do.
We're talking to Slate senior editor Sam Adams about the changing landscape of streaming television services, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What show, if any, or shows would you recommend streaming? What streaming services have you signed on to or happily canceled? Have you taken advantage of free trials that some streaming services offer to binge that one show and then give it all up? Is there a show you started and then it went away? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Sam Adams, senior editor at Slate. The headline of his recent article is Peak TV is Over. Welcome to Trough TV. We're talking about the ways that streaming television is changing and what it means for the way we watch and what we have there to watch. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your streaming experiences for better or worse. How do you decide which channel to subscribe to, if any? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rebecca is with us in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to comment on some of the stuff I've been streaming. I'm one of those kind of people who waits until everything is done and completed, and then 2 years later, I'll watch it. So, like, now I'm watching Breaking Bad. I never saw it, so I'm new to this. And I tried when everybody else was watching, and I couldn't get into it, but now I am. So I just finished season one, and I started season two. And I said I did the same thing with, like, The Sopranos. I bought HBO Max so I could watch The Sopranos. I wanted to see what the big deal was about. Honestly, I didn't like it, and I'll tell you why. I think they make shows differently for streaming now than they used to when you had to wait a week to watch them. So if you stream something that people had to wait a week for in the previous years, it comes off differently. There's no suspense. It doesn't make as much, I don't know. The drama isn't the same.
Rebecca, thanks for that call. Okay, Sam, Rebecca gives us a lot to work with there. First of all, the wait and see approach, I often take that with shows. Now, Rebecca, with like something like Breaking Bad, it had its full run. It had a conclusion. She's not going to get burned by it being canceled halfway through. I think it's a pretty cagey way to watch shows, and I'm guessing that streamers hate that, like the people who produce it.
Rebecca's bringing up some of my very favorite topics here. One is, which I think there was a survey that came out last week that said something like 25% of American TV viewers will wait until the show is over, not just the season, but the whole thing, to start watching it. And because streamers are now canceling shows in the middle of their runs, and not even a lot of times in the last 10 years, they would say, okay, well, we're not going to give you another season, but you can have a movie, you can have four episodes, just because it's more valuable to us to have a complete story, because people don't want to start something they can't finish. They're not really playing that game anymore, and people are wise to that, and they don't want to start a story if it's not going to end. So that is really keeping people away from watching these shows. And I do think it's been interesting in the last couple of years to watch even Netflix pull away from, which really branded the binge drop. That was their whole model, was you'll get the whole thing at once. You're not going to have to wait for anything. It's all yours whenever you want it. And they've been pulling back from that and releasing shows, either splitting seasons up, releasing some of their reality shows, you know, one or two episodes at a time. They're really coming back to the wisdom that the TV model that was built up over, you know, 70, 80 years of showing people something 1 week, giving people a week to think about it and anticipate what's going to happen next, and then giving another episode. There's that, people still like to watch TV that way. There's something very satisfying about that model, something that you don't start on a Friday evening and finish on Saturday night. So that's, you know, for my money, that's one of the good old things that's coming back, but it is another sign that some of the paradigm shifts that streaming was supposed to bring about have not been as total as they were going to be.
Rebecca, thanks for that call. Rebecca also brings up the idea that if you're making a show for immediate binging and streaming versus once a week, whether that's broadcast or dropping an episode, you know, every Wednesday or whatever on streaming, are you making the show differently?
Yes. I mean, there's so many ways in which that's true. And there's a whole sort of behind the scenes component to it when the business is just structured very differently now. On the Writers Guild of TV and movie writers is very close to going on strike in the next couple of weeks, in large part because the way they're paid for things has not kept up with the way streaming is structured. They're making, you know, they're paid by the episode, but these shows take longer to make. So they are fewer episodes, and each episode takes longer to make. So they're effectively making less money per hour. And they're not getting, you know, the residual payments for things being broadcast, because streaming networks don't like to tell you how many times people have seen your show. And yes, it also has the effect the episodes get longer, that the cliffhangers, I think, get less compelling, because all you have to do is convince somebody to not get up off their couch or hit a button. You don't have to convince them to, like, physically turn it on their TV a week. So I think it does. I mean, it's, you know, streaming has done so many wonderful things for television, and I want to pretend like things are worse now than they were 10 years ago across the board, but it has led to some kind of sloppiness in storytelling that I think is now might be a good time to pull back on.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rebecca, at 800-642-1234. Talking about changes in streaming TV with Sam Adams from Slate.com. Now, here's a show that's doing a little, something a little funky along these lines. One I've actually watched, and I'll say enjoyed. It's on Peacock, the show Poker Face. This is kind of giving the basic element here, this clip.
You're not reading the cards.
How could I read the cards?
You're reading me. It's not like it's one thing, like my eye twitches or something.
Nah.
It's just a general,
yeah.
You can just tell.
Just that something is off. That's the best way to describe it. I could just tell.
When anyone is lying, 100% of the time, I'm going to touch my nose.
No, it doesn't work like that. I'm not a soothsayer. I can't predict the future. There's nothing mystical about it. Just if someone is intentionally lying, that's it.
Okay, so this has a mystery of the week feel. It's got a character who walks the earth, different cast of characters every time. She solves the mystery. You could come in and out wherever you want. You know, there's things like the Fugitive or the Hulk or the A-Team. I don't know. This felt very old school to me. Is this a different way to tackle streaming, Sam?
It's both different and old, which is one of the things that I love about Poker Face. I mean, this is very Rian Johnson, who created the show with Natasha Lyonne, has been very open that this is just Columbo with Natasha Lyonne instead of Peter Falk. And I mean, I'd give him all my money just for that synopsis. But yeah, this is a case of the week show. There's virtually no continuity from one episode to the next. When they sent out the screeners to press, they made a big deal about, you know what, you can watch these in any order you want, which is just, nobody makes TV like that anymore. And it's also a sort of golden age of streaming show, in that Peacock, far and away above all the other streaming networks, is just losing money hand over fist. They lost $2.5 billion last year. They expect to lose $3 billion this year. They're the least watched and most expense and most money losing of all the streaming networks. But they're just, you know, taking Rian Johnson, this very successful director who made the Knives Out movies and The Last Jedi, throwing you a bunch of money, saying like, hey, why don't you come up with a crazy idea and we'll give you money to do it. And this is, you know, so many of my favorite shows of the last 10 years kind of follow that pattern, where it's just, here's an artist with a crazy idea. We don't know if anybody's going to like it or not, but we don't know what works in this medium yet. So let's just like give them some money and see what happens. And that's how you got Atlanta. That's how you got The Rehearsal last year. So, you know, because you got Orange Is the New Black, almost 10 years ago on Netflix. So many of the shows that really defined what has made the streaming era special for me. And those are, for me, I mean, those are Poker Face notwithstanding. Those are some of the things that are going away now. Those kind of little quirky shows, like some of the ones that got canceled last year, like Weatherford Falls, Los Espookies, Tuca and Birdie. Those were really just very niche, personal, idiosyncratic shows. And that's what has been so interesting about the last 10 years of TV for me. And that is one of the reasons why I think we're kind of over the peak and heading into the trough, is because those shows in particular seem to be the things that are getting cut, and I miss them.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jim is with us in Watertown. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. So I know this isn't really a product of the streaming that's going on now, but since this, you know, hurry up and get the program on the air mentality has got going, is the way I'm looking at it anyways. They've taken away the contrasting image of characters. Like, there used to be a lot of the good guy or the bad guy. And now it seems like they're trying to make everybody this multifaceted character. And that's great, but without the difference, the contrast, it really seems to be taking away from the content of the stories.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. And Sam, this, like with the HBO prestige TV Sopranos, you got the anti-heroes or villain as hero, whatever you want to call it, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, probably the list goes on and on. I don't know. Have we overdone the getting away from good guys and bad guys?
Well, yeah, this is what's part of what's happened is, I mean, you mentioned Sopranos and Mad Men and The Americans, which, again, I love. But yeah, this sort of prestige TV, not just as a descriptor of like, this is a really good show, but as a kind of mode of making TV, as a something that you can watch 2 minutes of and be like, oh, this wants to be prestige TV. Yeah, that's really kind of narrowed the range of things that are on the air. And what I think the caller was talking about is, you know, we used to think of it as more like TV, like where there are good guys and bad guys. And, you know, Poker Face is a show like that, where like, mm-hmm. you know who the killers are right from the beginning. They're not good people. You know that the main character is going to catch them out and the crime's going to get solved. That kind of simplicity and I'd say predictability, not in a bad way, but that kind of comfort and regularity from it is something that I think maybe has been a little too overthought. And now you look at the success of a show like Abbott Elementary, which is the most successful new network sitcom in years. And I think there is a craving to get back to some of that sort of stuff. Like, just give me 22 minutes of funny characters 22 times a year, and I'm happy.
Thanks a lot for that call. Sam, in our last half minute, what is the big question you have for the rest of this year in streaming?
I mean, we're going to have to see, you know, how many of these new shows that are coming out. The executives I talked to point to, you know, all this great stuff that is coming, and we'll see if it's as great as the stuff that came out. But the writers and the creatives that I've talked to are really saying that this is the worst time that they can remember for trying to make something interesting. So we'll make up our list at the end of the year and see who comes out ahead.
Sam, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Sam Adams is a senior editor at Slate.com. He joins today with a look at the way streaming services are changing, adapting, what it all means for those of us who watch stuff. Music here, the theme song from Succession, just began its fourth and final season on HBO Max this weekend. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the record-setting amount of money going into the state Supreme Court race, how the campaigns and outside groups are spending their cash. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, opening day for Major League Baseball is tomorrow, and some new rules are in place for the season. We'll talk to a baseball statistician about what's changed and how it affects the game. Now, Tuesday's state Supreme Court election between conservative-backed candidate Daniel Kelly and liberal-backed candidate Janet Protasiewicz is the most expensive race of its type in U.S. history. Gained that title last month, according to the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, the candidates have raised a combined $39 million. Ads backing Protasiewicz dominated the field for a few weeks, but now pro-Kelly ads have apparently taken the lead. Outside from groups from around the country are also getting involved in the race, which could swing the ideological balance of the court in favor of liberals for the first time since 2008. We're talking about the money and the messaging in the final days before the election. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the amount of money and out-of-state attention that the race is getting? It's an officially nonpartisan race. Does it feel nonpartisan to you, or do you treat it like any other partisan election? Are you seeing ads on TV, on streaming, online? Are they negative, missing the mark on the issues you care about? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Christina LaPlante is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW La Crosse. Christina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Big, expensive state Supreme Court race. Can you give us the basics on what is bringing so much cash into this campaign?
Well, yeah, my goodness, as you just noted, as of last month, right, just shy of $40 million, becoming the most expensive court race in United States history. And that's all for a good reason. I think that there's three big takeaways here about why this race is attracting so much attention. So first, obviously, we got to talk about the balance of power. The winner of this race is going to determine the ideological composition of the court, which currently has a 4-3 conservative majority and pro de se, which could very much be the changing factor there. As you noted, having a liberal majority for the first time since 2008. Of course, on the other hand, we've got the issue of abortion. The overturning of Roe versus Wade apparently remains a central policy focus for Democrats, especially with the 1849 Wisconsin law that makes it a felony to provide abortions. And, you know, with what we've got Josh Call, the attorney general, doing, we very much should expect to see some type of abortion case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So you've got a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm there. You've got gerrymandering, right? What are we going to do about the gerrymandered maps in the state of Wisconsin? And then you've got national implications, which I think is why you're seeing so much outside spending, you know, large individual donors from other states, national policy organizations. You know, don't forget that in 2020, it was the Wisconsin Supreme Court that narrowly voted just by 4-3 to block an attempt by Trump allies to throw out a couple hundred thousand ballots in those liberal-leaning counties. So there is a lot of work for the Supreme Court to do, and I feel like I'm just kind of skimming the surface of why this race is getting so much attention.
Right, and on a dollar-per-vote ratio, this is going to be really high. These are spring elections, traditionally not high turnout. The primary had about 20%, which doesn't sound high, but by Supreme Court spring election standards, really pretty high compared to, you know, even some final Supreme Court elections in the state. That said, it isn't going to look like turnout for a presidential or a Senate or governor election. What do you see when it comes to money versus turnout in this race?
Well, 20% certainly does sound small, but in the context of how these elections normally go, I think on average it's been, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15% turnout over the last decade or so, just talking about kind of, you know, Wisconsin special elections, especially court elections. But, you know, that's nothing to blush about, this 20%. Moreover, you know, like you said, we've got high turnout, you know, about 60% for our presidential elections, 40% for midterms, and then all of our special elections, you know, you're really lucky to get a fifth of voters turning out there. But not only are we seeing turnout consistently increasing, but who is increasing is equally important. You know, there's a reason that majority of these ads are airing on Facebook and Instagram. They, you know, especially the Pro De Sayowitz campaign, right? They want to hit that younger Gen Z voter. They want them to see these advertisements and they want them to turn out. And I fully expect turnout to be on par, if not higher, on April 4th.
Now, one thing that makes it hard in the journalism world to talk about these elections is they're nonpartisan elections. So there's this sort of elaborate facade of a nonpartisan election. And yet one candidate is nonpartisan, but all the Democratic funding goes to them. And another candidate's nonpartisan and all the Republican funding, and I'm talking parties and groups, special interest groups and so on, goes to that candidate. Can you talk about the sort of air quotes we could throw around nonpartisan here?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't feel like a nonpartisan contest, does it? And I think I just read not too long ago that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin is officially Pro De Sayowitz's largest donor. So, and moreover, when we look at the types of policy organizations, you know, pro-choice versus pro-life, many of those organizations are throwing money at their respective candidates on either side of this line. So I think we have to really sit and think about the purpose of a nonpartisan contest, what role the judiciary plays in our government and our institutions, and we seem to be very clearly deviating from that. I don't think you could find a single Wisconsin voter who would agree with the fact that, yeah, this very much seems like a nonpartisan contest to me.
Talking to Christina Plant, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse, looking at big, big money in Wisconsin State Supreme Court race, breaking a national record for state Supreme Court races. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jed is with us in Lacouture. Jed, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
Oh, just a few things. I'm just kind of bummed out with the larger system, not only the specific election, either for Supreme Court in Wisconsin or the recent Senate race in Georgia. It's like, seems like you got to pay to play so that people are buying elections, they're buying politicians, they're buying policy. And it just seems like a lose-lose situation to me. And it's not the lesser of two losers or the lesser of two evils. It's still a loser and it's still evil. It's like putting gas in a broken car. It's just a bummer. It's not merit-based. Perhaps we should have an electoral system with no money at all.
Jed, thanks a lot for the call. Christina, I think Jed not alone feeling disillusioned with the amount of money that goes into politics and him saying you got to pay to play in the political game.
Yeah, and what an exceptionally frustrating sentiment to feel about one's own democracy, and certainly shared with millions of Americans. And races didn't always used to be like this, especially nonpartisan races. It wasn't until 2008 and the Citizens United court case ruling, where now, as long as outside groups aren't directly coordinating with campaigns, they can basically spend unlimited amounts of money, you know, for influencing elections, right? There's no other way around that. That's what they're doing. And absolutely, right? How do we get out of this? How do we get out of this hole? You know, we need real campaign finance reform. You know, that's really the only way that we can start rebuilding the reputation and legitimacy of our political institutions. And you know, not falling victim to this belief that very, you know, frequently accurate belief that our politicians are bought.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jed, at 800-642-1234. Nate joins us now in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. The big concern I have is that the gerrymandering means we don't have a legislature that represents us. And as a citizen, one of the things we go to the legal system for is to protect our rights. And part of those rights is to have a legislature that represents us. So anybody that says this should be discussed in the legislature, well, we need to actually have a legislature that works for that to happen. Something that a previous caller mentioned about money in politics sparked a memory, in that Wisconsin used to have public funding for elections. So that's something that we could actually potentially return to help deal with this problem. And a small thing that hasn't made any of the press so far is the Milwaukee Bar Association did its qualified, not qualified recommendations for anybody running for judge statewide or in this area. A lot more of them actually ended up saying Kelly was not qualified than Protasewicz. So I thought that was and these are people who have voted qualified for people that were appointed by Republicans. So I think that's actually a little less partisan thing to go by.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. To Nate's first point, Christina, you mentioned redistricting, the way our political lines are drawn in Wisconsin. This has come up a lot as a likely case that could end up coming before the state Supreme Court over the next year or two. How have you heard that talked about in the race?
Well, yeah, first of all, a lot of excellent points brought up just then. But I think what all of these really excellent questions and comments are getting at is that there is severe disillusionment in this country about any branch of government's ability to be impartial, any ability to write and pass and execute laws in a way that benefits society as a whole, rather than just some specific narrow partisan agenda. So obviously in the state of Wisconsin, we look to the state legislature to redraw these district boundaries. However, we, you know, perceive that through a partisan lens. There's the gerrymandering problem. Well, let's look to the courts to fix that. Well, now, you know, even though we ought to have these nonpartisan races, which they're very clearly not partisan, even our courts, right, the one institution supposed to be impartial, is also falling victim to this partisan problem. I think what I hope a lot of people kind of take away from this who are feeling this way is recognizing that there are options and that change is possible. There's other states that are doing things in different ways that help kind of remove this partisan shadow from democratic processes, maybe some movement or momentum for independent commissions. I think California, a handful of other states have independent commissions where they're responsible for redrawing these district lines. So if we can't trust politicians to do their job in an unbiased fashion, maybe we should start considering taking away some of those responsibilities.
Thanks for that call, Nate. We're talking to UW La Crosse political science professor Christina LaPlante about the money going into the race for the state Supreme Court and the issues the two candidates are focusing on in their ads. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing a lot of ads on social media, on streaming, on broadcast TV, on the radio, you name it? What do you think? Does it leave you feeling motivated, burnt out? Do you think we need to change the rules after all this money goes into this one state Supreme Court seat race? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Christina LaPlante, assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse. We're looking at the record-setting amount of money that's gone into the race for an open seat on our state Supreme Court, what the campaigns are doing with that money in their ads on TV and social media. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Christina, let's talk about the messaging now. Let's start with the Kelly campaign and groups backing him. What are you seeing when it comes to the messaging on that side of the race?
One thing that has really stood out to me is the co-opting of Trump-style messaging that we're seeing coming from the Kelly campaign. Trump loves his nicknames, Ron D. Sanctimonious, Sleepy Joe Biden. I love the No Jail Janet that the Kelly campaign has been using to refer to Protasiewicz, really using a lot of, in my opinion, some Willie Horton style advertising from the 88 contest between Bush and Dukakis, where during Dukakis's time as Massachusetts governor, he had this furlough program for inmates and, you know, this notorious case of Willie Horton, who committed several crimes while on furlough. It's eerily similar. Like, go watch that advertisement. Watch the Willie Horton advertisement and compare it to some of these No Jail Janet advertisements from the Kelly campaign. They are eerily similar. But this idea of, you know, Democrats are too soft on crime. They don't have what it takes to make the tough decisions to, you know, lead or act effectively. I think that's one of the biggest things that I'm seeing that probably has the greatest potential to resonate with potential voters on a variety of levels.
Now, the soft on crime ads in Wisconsin's state Supreme Court are pretty common. One thing that the state Supreme Court really doesn't do is hear criminal trials directly. Like, they might get an obscure technicality that percolates up from the court. Basically, if you're arrested in Wisconsin, you're probably not going to end up before the state Supreme Court. So it's interesting that keeps getting focused on so much year after year in these races.
Of course. And maybe we're hearing about the constitutionality of some type of tough on crime law that might go before the Supreme Court. But by and large, you're right. I mean, criminal cases often aren't heard at the Supreme Court. And that's just further evidence that voters should be picking up on that we have very much deviated from a nonpartisan contest in both camps. I think both candidates are guilty of this, of playing on to, you know, very political stereotypes about liberalism and conservatism that are really just being used as part of this numbers game. What's the scariest, biggest message I can deliver to voters to make sure that they're turning out on April 4th?
And then the same question, the Protasiewicz campaign itself and supporters, what are the main lines of messaging there?
I would say the biggest one has to be abortion access. I think you have Democratic strategists who saw how wildly successful that messaging was in the 2022 midterms, how there was not this red wave of Republicans taking Congress. And I think Democrats attributed a lot of that to mobilization and energy and enthusiasm about, well, kind of negatively, right, about the Dobbs decision. And this is what happens when we don't participate in politics, right? We've got to get out there. We've got to fight for our rights. And out of all of the advertisements that I have seen, besides the rather silly advertisement from Protasiewicz about how to pronounce her name, which reminded me a lot of the Lisa Murkowski advertisement when she was a write-in candidate. Besides that, it overwhelmingly seems to me fear-based messages from the Protasiewicz campaign about what's going to happen to women's rights and their ability to choose if she's not elected.
Let's go back to our callers with Mary on the line in Milwaukee. Mary, hello.
Hi there. So I am thinking that I don't like any of the ads at all from either candidate, partly because it's such an assault. If you watch the morning news on any channel, it's like one string-pulling, abusive commercial after another. They're terribly manipulative. And although I'm pro-choice, my other point is I feel like Judge Protasiewicz is not doing anything beyond demonstrating that she is in favor of protecting the rights of childbearing age women. And as far as I can tell from the ads, it's white women at that. I mean, I'm not hearing any desire to reach out beyond the choir.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. A couple big points there, Christina, the like incessant negative stream of ads out there that Mary's seeing can bring a person down, maybe another way to disillusion people about politics.
Yeah, there's absolutely a tipping point when it comes to how negative can a campaign be before it starts demobilizing voters. I think one thing that's happening now is that with all of the contention and the polarization and the, I think one of the central things happening right now in American politics is this concept of morality politics. In other words, there's a right way to live and there's a wrong way to live. And we're very much developing this conservative morality policy and this liberal morality policy that liberals have a correct way of living. And that is the absolute opposite of what a conservative perceives to be the right way of living. And with that kind of social undercurrent, I think that empowers candidates more to go negative, to take the fear message, to take the anger message, because they can kind of get away with it a little bit more. And more to the point of who do you see represented in these advertisements? Again, you put these two cues together and you know exactly who's being marketed to, right? I think it's overwhelmingly for Democrats, the youth vote, wanting to scare Gen Z and younger voters and maybe even millennials into participating. You will lose your rights if you do not participate. And then conservatives, on the other hand, taking the classic crime frame that if we have a government run by liberals, we'll just have criminals running in the street.
Time for one more caller. Leo is with us in Milwaukee. Leo, hello.
Hey. I first got the vote in 1970, at which time there was only three networks, of course, and there was very few political ads, and they generally focused on issues. Today, I have to say my opinion of the political process is the great spinning mud machine. You take items out of context that look bad, spin it around, make it look as bad as possible, and throw it on the air. As far as the Supreme Court race goes, I have seen exactly one positive ad.
Wow.
That's not slinging mud at the other side, and it was a Protasiewicz ad.
Leo, thanks for the call. Christina, a great spinning mud machine.
I am definitely going to start using that terminology in my campaigns and elections course. I hope that's okay. I love that phrase. But I think that this all just boils down to the fact that we've kind of lost touch with, I think politicians have really lost touch and how they can effectively communicate with voters. And there's really far less emphasis on issues these days. And it really is all about that emotional appeal. And despite, decades of public opinion survey where people say election year after election year, I hate it. I hate how negative these campaigns are. I can't stand the advertising. But it doesn't change. Politicians still spend, or candidates rather, overwhelming percentages of their budget go just to advertisements, and they're exactly that emotional disposition that we all agree we dislike. So why did they keep doing it? Unfortunately, the answer is they work.
Thanks for that call. And Christina, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Christina LaPlante, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. She is with us to talk about the final days of campaigning in the race for state Supreme Court. That race has brought in almost $40 million to the candidates, making it the most expensive state Supreme Court race in U.S. history. A related note coming up here on Central Time to talk about some of the disillusionment and polarization. Guest makes the case that we have had a great pulling apart, she calls it, in the United States. But she says it can be fixed. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Hey, let's hop in our DeLorean cars, eat some Limeade Oreos, and raise a glass of new Coke to celebrate the great failures of recent product design. The Museum of Failure is a traveling exhibit started in Sweden about 6 years ago, and it's back in the United States. Now, it's in New York City for an extended stay, but if you don't have a visit planned, that's okay. You can see a lot of the exhibit at museumoffailure.com. The museum features products that swung and missed, that tried something new that didn't pan out so good. But the goal is not to make fun of the product or their creators, but to celebrate the role of failure as part of innovation and creativity. So New Coke didn't catch on, but the Coca-Cola company is still there, last I checked. Oreo has released some new flavors that caught on a lot better than Limeade. And the DeLorean car, it was in the Back to the Future movies, so that's cool. Celebrating failure, this is Central Time.